Welcome into A Place for Healing from Bethesda Workshops in Nashville, Tennessee. Glad to be with you here on our program today. And I am Jim Kress, joined by Christian psychologist and author Dr. Ted Baldick, who is my colleague at Bethesda Workshops. And we've worked together a long, long time here, helping men especially get on the road to recovery from sexual addiction. So our time together is not just about, well, we're going to talk about neurochemistry and many of the aspects of the brain and recovery. We've got a personal relationship. It's just good to be here chatting with you today, Ted.
Thanks, Jim. Glad to be here.
Let's first just start off and kind of answer the question, why would we even need to talk about the brain? I mean, people think we have the Bible, we have the practical tools and all like that, and why is the brain even such an important thing? Because we, in the counseling field, sure hear so much about the brain these days.
Well, one of the things that we've come to really understand is that in addictions, and all addictions, they're truly brain diseases. And that you can't really be addicted to something that doesn't mimic something that God has not put in right proportion in the brain. And with sexual addiction, it's no different, that we have an emotional and a spiritual part of that compulsive use of sexual material, but there is also a neurochemical part, and that is that we're addicted to the neurochemical dopamine.
You know, we have heard I know people who are certainly in the counseling field hear so much about dopamine or serotonin and transmitters and all that goes with that. The whole idea of the science of the brain, you teach this lecture at Bethesda Workshops. I always like when I see the guys, and I've seen it so many times, they'll have like the light come on where they go, this explains, almost like a missing link, because they had kind of disconnected from the brain. They don't understand that the brain's a rather important sex organ. And so there's a lot of, we often call it psychoeducation, that's needed. Maybe even to our listeners today, some of who will be therapists listening to this program, that importance of understanding what's going on in the brain, especially on sexual addiction, that's not something that's two or three layers down. This should be near the top of understanding, shouldn't it?
Absolutely. It's like the rest of the story.
Yeah.
It's what takes place behind the scenes. It's operating all the time. One of the reasons cravings become so difficult is because they come out of a neurochemical process, that those are internal. They're often related to our memories, to our traumas of the past, and they get triggered in multiple ways. And when they do, then it excites or sets up that need to act out.
When we say, you and I have said this, that every sex addict truly is a drug addict, is that an overstatement?
No, it's not an overstatement. Even your secular theorists, and if you look on some of the websites, even from the National Institute of Health, they are promoting the exact same thing, that addiction is a brain disease. And that we have to start taking that seriously and addressing that in our treatment.
Let's just dive in with this this study we're going to do today, this kind of a psychoeducational piece around the brain. First of all, I just want to get this one out on the table because I always think it's fascinating. Guys will say, I know you've done this, I've done this with guys, I'll say, especially in a workshop setting, tell me what you had to eat two nights ago for supper. They can't remember. Tell me about the first porn you looked at and or masturbated to it, and they can describe it in the most incredible details. Just tell us what that's about.
It becomes kindled. It is just frozen in our amygdala, if you will, and our memory holds it, and we're excited by it, and it usually is something that takes place when we were young, and we were exposed to something as a little kid that we probably shouldn't have been exposed to. We didn't quite know what it was. We knew it was exciting. We also knew it was scary. we knew it was forbidden, and yet we wanted to go back to it. And then later, when we're exposed to more overt sexual material, that comes flooding back in almost like a tsunami.
Yeah, and the idea that a person says they've developed what we call, or Patrick Carnes has called this, arousal template, guys will say, well, I'm attracted more to this body part or that body part or this type. Sometimes it's ethnicity and all like that. We do work, as you well know, we do work called a trauma egg, where we're looking at their life story. But it's really interesting, isn't it, why so many different guys in a room full of sex addicts, can be attracted to so many different things, isn't it?
And some of the things they're attracted to, others will look at and go, what?
Yeah.
But it is what it was connected to. How could, for one person, the physical abuse that they took that took place in their lives become eroticized? But it does. How could some of the sexual abuse that takes place become eroticized? But it does. How could some of the neglect that takes place with families become eroticized? But it does. It is how it is interpreted or misinterpreted by that little person at that time that sets up that arousal template.
Let's talk about just basically some of the key parts of the brain and how they are tied in to addiction. I've said in your lecture many times at Bethesda workshops on this, and I always find it honestly very, very fascinating, the different parts of the brain, the roles they play. Let's take us through some of those. I know it's an audio recording. This is not something they can see, but let's take a little tour of the brain, shall we?
Okay. The ones that we're most concerned about is kind of in the center of the brain, which is the amygdala, which deals with the fight or flight and freeze mechanism. It's the thing that when we're frightened by something, we either are running from it, running to it, or scared to death and not moving.
Right.
And it also is very connected to our memories, particularly our trauma memories. And so things that occur in everyday life can trigger into the amygdala some of those memories. For instance, if, for me, I have an elevator phobia, and it comes from being trapped by some adults thinking they were doing the right thing at surgery, and I believed as a little kid they were going to kill me, and I had just come off an elevator, and that became associated.
Mm.
And so that as I approach an elevator, my anxiety comes up because of what comes back in my memory is that being pinned against a chair and hit with an ether mask and thinking they were trying to kill me. And I can consciously tell you that there is nothing there that bothers, that shouldn't bother me at all. Right. There's no issue there. I know that, but in my memory, it's still associated.
This trauma response, I mean, it's not like you're willfully calling this up. We all know this. It's just there.
It's just there. And as people with addictions work with their traumas, they are confronting these triggers and this kindling that's taken place, and they have to accept it. They may not like it, but it doesn't change the fact that it's operating, and it's one of the reasons they have trouble staying sober.
Let's take a little tour of that pleasure center of the brain. What's it called? What's around it? And what are some of the things that fire that thing up?
Well, the pleasure center of the brain is fired by dopamine. And people who kind of enjoy life, if you were to do a PET scan, that would kind of glow a nice, bright, beautiful red. But people who have fewer dopamine receptors, and that's what we believe, people have a harder time experiencing pleasure, we believe that they have fewer dopamine receptors, they're looking for something more to fire that dopamine. And what we realize is with sexual fantasy, the amount of dopamine that gets fired into the system, it is is very much like a hit of cocaine, and it fires that pleasure center, so it goes from kind of a dull yellow to a bright red. If I'm a food addict, it goes from that dull yellow, and as soon as I get that Twinkie, it starts lighting up because it's that anticipation of getting that pleasure. And that's one of the reasons that sex addiction is so powerful, is because it fires that so much dopamine that it hits that pleasure. And like with a cocaine addict, they chase the original high. Each man is trying to get that high back again, except the original high can never be achieved, just like it couldn't be with crack, couldn't be with cocaine, couldn't be with heroin. They can't get that original. They just keep chasing it, and they build a tolerance. The brain tries to down-regulate. The more we push these drugs into the brain says, wait a minute, I'm not supposed to have all of that. And God has so designed it is that we try to down-regulate. And as the brain tries to down-regulate, it takes more and more and more, and for the sex addict, more deeply erotic material to get the same high. And that's why it's a progressive disease. It may start, they think, fairly small. I'm just looking at a few pictures of women, and over the years, they've ended up looking at pornography that they would have never thought of looking at. They have crossed the flesh lines in ways that they would have never thought, always because they're trying to get that high, because what originally aroused them can't do it anymore because the brain's trying to down-regulate it, so they have to overpower the brain with the dopamine.
Well, and you've talked about this anticipatory factor. There are not just PET scans, but fMRIs, functional MRI studies that were done in Nashville at Vanderbilt University. And so you can see a brain show a guy porn, and his brain begins to light up. And so guys will say, well, I just go into fantasy in the addiction cycle, or I'm just, as I call it, snacking on some pictures. And I've coined a term that I've not heard anywhere else. I just call it brain masturbation, trying to tell guys your brain is masturbating, whether you're touching yourself, whether you're masturbating or not. So fantasy really in the brain is not a freebie, is it?
It is not a freebie, because we carry our drug in our with us all the time. Yeah. It's in our brain. And most men have seen so many images and done so many things that they can create enough fantasies to fire up that amount of dopamine. They don't even have to do anything else. That's what makes this so powerful in addiction, is because it's with you all the time. And recovery is, I've got to change my brain. I have to change the way I think, and I have to change the way I respond. And I have to understand that I will be aroused by certain things, and I have to have tools that allow me to move toward a pro-recovery way of experiencing those kind of arousals.
I like that, pro-recovery. We're going to take a break here in just a moment and get into more of the specifics on the neurochemistry aspect of sexual addiction recovery. And we're in a couple of decades, I guess, of a period that you can't read anything out there on the internet or in research or the books that continue to come out that seems like every time you turn a page, it's the brain, and it's important. The scriptures say we are fearfully and wonderfully made, and we do not want to leave the brain out of our recovery. And we'll get back into some very practical helps on this in just a moment. You're listening to A Place for Healing from Bethesda Workshops. I'm Jim Kress here with Dr. Ted Baldick, and we'll be back with more right after this.
Here is the executive and clinical director of Bethesda Workshops, author and conference speaker Marnie Faree.
Bethesda Workshops is a place for healing from sex and relationship addiction. Located in Nashville, Tennessee, we offer help and hope to those who are personally struggling and to their partners. Our four-day intensive workshops are the equivalent of 8 to 12 months of weekly counseling. It's the most cost-effective and easiest way to get a huge jump start or boost in the healing process.
Contact Bethesda Workshops today at BethesdaWorkshops.org or 1-866-464-HEAL. That's 866-464-4325 or BethesdaWorkshops.org.
For Healing from Bethesda Workshops in Nashville, Tennessee. Thanks so much for joining us. I am Jim Kress here with my colleague and good friend, Dr. Ted Baldick, psychologist and author, and a man who has, I think more than anybody I've ever seen, has such a integration and balance of the Word of God, his knowledge and application of the Word of God, and he's taught Sunday school for so many years, and has had an incredible background as a nurse. So he's been in the medical profession and then helping so many people on the front lines of their lives in many ways, including in this field of addiction, and specifically sexual addiction. We're talking about the brain, the whole neurochemical and neurobiological piece of sexual addiction recovery. You don't want to leave the brain out of your recovery plan. And Ted, let's get back to some of the specific neurochemicals that are connected to or associated with sexual activity. A little psycho-ed piece again on this.
Okay. There are several neurochemicals that are related to sexual addiction. One is serotonin, and serotonin is most frequently thought of as the neurochemical that is directly related to issues of depression. It is considered the fortitude chemical. It's the kind of chemical that helps us to feel that we personally can manage or take on adversity. And people low in serotonin feel overwhelmed by adversity. And it doesn't mean we like adversity, but it's like we can take it on. So serotonin, or the fortitude chemical, is one of it that is actively involved. And so that many sexual addicts need to be evaluated for a mood disorder. They may be part of the problem they have is that they may have serotonin insufficiency, and medication can help them, and that's a tool in their recovery.
So what happens if someone, let's say, gets on an SSRI, a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, and they say that they feel a real change even in their body, and it's as though their battle with lust or temptation sexually goes down? What would be dynamically kind of what just went on if they're on, say, an SSRI?
Well, what might be happening is that as serotonin goes up, they have less need for other chemicals for excitement to take place. And also, as serotonin goes up, it tends to slightly curb sexual appetite. Mm-hmm. And so it brings it down. And so if you think of it as a person has gone to the top of a hill they're not supposed to be on, it brings them down to the midline, which is where they were supposed to be in the first place.
Right. So that's serotonin. And before we get to, I'm going to go back to have you say a word again about dopamine for a moment. How do serotonin and dopamine, if they do, work together? I mean, if they work together, they shake hands, they work together at all. How do they?
Well, I'm not certain that I can give you physiologically what happens. I know that, particularly in depression, that dopamine and serotonin can work together because certain people are unable to feel pleasure or unable to feel energy. And they have found that certain medications that promote dopamine, particularly alongside of an SSRI, they feel like they can handle the problem better, and with this other medication, like, for instance, Wellbutrin, it promotes more dopamine, their energy comes up, they begin to see color in life again, and their brain begins to work a little differently, that is the prefrontal cortex and the frontal lobe of the brain begins to light up a little better, and they begin to not only see things differently, but think differently. That is, wait a minute, do I want to keep doing it this way?
Yeah.
And so dopamine is one of the primary neurochemicals in the brain. It is the neurochemical that's in deficiency with Parkinson's disease. It's the neurochemical that seems to be problematic with ADHD. That is, we have to promote more dopamine to get that left frontal lobe of their brain operating. It is the pleasure center neurochemical. Right now, everybody's using dopamine is like the drug in the brain, but it is. It takes care of so many different aspects of how we operate emotionally and intellectually.
So if we could sign up for and get a little increase, get a little shot of some serotonin and some dopamine, that'd be a good one to have.
In other words, could we switch one drug addiction for another? but probably that's not what we need to do, because it's not artificially putting it in. It's looking at where is their deficiency, and then how do we meet the deficiency, rather than this panacea, if we give everybody these drugs, then no one's going to have any problems. And that's not true, because we have found that people who don't need serotonin and they get it, they get sick.
All right, we hear a lot about in the addiction field, especially around sexual addiction, about norepinephrine. What is that drug or that neurotransmitter about, and why is it important?
Norepinephrine is a neurochemical that, when it is low in the brain, we have more obsessional worries. It's often connected with depression. People have lower serotonin levels, lower norepinephrine, and the depressive person who has both of those, they have this depression with this just awful, obsessive worry. And for the Christian, it's almost invariably spiritual issues. Constantly worrying about, was I good enough? Did I really get saved? Can God really love me? Oh, I had an awful thought about God. Could he possibly forgive me for that? It's like they become obsessed with these things, and they find no joy in life. And so when norepinephrine is able to be increased in the brain, this obsessional rumination begins to come down. And so it's related to often like an adrenaline-like aspect. That is, if it's up, if it gets really high, there's this excitement, there's this rush that takes place. And so remember, the Bible says that essentially that we are to live in moderation in all things. Well, there's a moderation of these drugs. That is, we've got to find baselines and stay in the middle zone. If we go high or low, we've always got problems. If we get outside of God's original plan, we're always in trouble.
There's a novel thought, isn't it? Getting outside of God's plan, including his plan for the brain. All right. Well, this is A Place for Healing. Jim Kress here with Dr. Ted Baldick, and we're talking about the neurochemical and neurobiological aspect of recovery, neurochemistry, brain issues today on our program. Let's talk about PEA. What is that, and what's it do for us?
PEA, which is phenylethylamine, some doubt that it's really a major problem. Others support it. What it appears to be is the excitement drug. It's the drug that kind of hits the brain in the new relationship. It's the guy that saw a girl and he really likes her and she's going to go out with him, and they start dating and they have this rush between them. And then it passes after they've been dating for a while, and one or the other one thinks, oh, what's wrong? So they go to a new relationship because they like the rush. They like the new relationship high. And it's a short-acting excitement chemical. Yeah. And so we have to be careful that when we're dating, that we're not chasing a dating high.
That's where I take the C off the word chemical and then put the word rush, a chemical rush, take the C and put it with rush, that's crush. And so when people say, I've got a crush on this person, and it seems around the first 90 days of a new relationship, there's some magic chemically that's going on. So people making decisions in the first 90 days, including to be sexual and all like that, there's a little problem with that, isn't there?
Not only to become sexual, but people race off and get married in those 3 months, and then they go, oh man, now what did I do? But I think part of it is that we are supposed to have that really excitement for that new person to kind of keep us interested, but that isn't how a relationship goes. It comes back down to how is it developed and nurtured. If we think that the excitement is the only thing that's a part of a relationship, we miss all the deeper intimacy of that relationship. If we get into a relationship and early into that relationship we're sexual, that relationship never deepens any deeper than the sheets we've climbed between. We have not taken the time to develop and know each other. We haven't taken the time to argue, to fight, to learn how to resolve conflict. And we haven't learned about the hopes and the dreams about each other. We're only trying to figure out when and where are we going to have sex.
Well, we're going to come back in just a moment and talk about a couple of other very important neurochemicals. Endorphins, one of my favorites, oxytocin, because of what goes on, and we all like our oxytocin. You'll find out about that. Dr. Ted Baldock is with us. I'm Jim Kress, and from Bethesda Workshops, you're listening to A Place for Healing, and we'll be right back.
Here is the executive and clinical director of Bethesda Workshops, author and conference speaker, Marnie Faree.
Bethesda Workshops uses the best clinical strategies shared by leaders who are at least master's level licensed counselors. All facilitators have specific training in treating sex addiction and underlying issues. A number of our staff are actually CSATs, which is the highest certification in our field. Bethesda Workshops is also a distinctly Christian program that emphasizes grace-based spiritual principles as the foundation for healing.
Contact Bethesda Workshops today at 1-866-464-4325. That's 866-464-4325 or bethesdaworkshops.org.
With you on A Place for Healing from Bethesda Workshops in Nashville, Tennessee. And I am Jim Kress here with Dr. Ted Baldock. Glad you're with us. Remember our website, BethesdaWorkshops.org, to find out more information and hear other of these programs that we've recorded here. And pass the word again about BethesdaWorkshops.org. We're going to talk, as I promised, about a couple more pretty key neurochemicals associated with sexual activity, and some certainly involved with sexual addiction. We said we do endorphins and oxytocin, one of my favorite. Let's start with endorphins. What role do they play?
Endorphins are play this role. The endorphins are calming chemicals. They're the chemicals that are related to opioids, things like painkillers, heroin. Those are all opioids. And endorphins calm and they can numb. Following sexual activity, endorphins will come in immediately following orgasm, and that's why a lot of wives get mad at guys, because the endorphin comes in, they feel so calm, they go off to sleep, and she
right.
doesn't want them to.
Right, yeah.
And so endorphins are also related to other kinds of addictive substances, and we can go into that later if you yeah. want to. Oxytocin is the bonding chemical, and it's the thing that's built in a relationship through non-sexual touch, and it's built through selfless acts. It's the chemical that that grows as we really feel connected to this person without fear of being emotionally or physically invaded. And so, you know, the kids that walk around holding hands or building oxytocin, the couple that can sit together, snuggle together and talk, and it's not being sexual, they're just being connected and enjoying the touch of each other. That's the building of oxytocin. And with that building, there's a natural progression toward wanting to become more sexual. And what happens in sex addiction is we try to bypass that. We try to get to the orgasmic aspect without ever building the bond.
Wow, that's something. As far as skipping over building the bond, we got a problem, right? Yeah.
We have a problem. And that's why so many men will talk about wives not being non-sexual. It's not that they're non-sexual. It is that they don't feel connected because he is pushing for sex rather than a relationship building, and she doesn't feel connected, she doesn't feel safe, because his touch is always sexual, it's never just pleasurable.
So there almost, maybe there's some truth to that old line that we've heard, that men will give closeness to experience sex, and women will give sex to experience closeness. We're coming at it from two different angles, aren't we?
Yeah, we have trains that pass each other. A man feels loved when the woman he's with makes love with him. A woman makes love with the man of her life when she feels loved. Hmm. And so it's two trains that pass each other. And so in every relationship, they have to find ways to connect or to bring those two trains, if you will, onto the same track. And understanding the how each of us operates, it's not like one of us is wrong and one of us is right, that in a relationship, it is understanding those two aspects. That is, God has asked us to be bilingual in a relationship.
Wow. Dr. Ted Baldock with us on A Place for Healing today. We're talking about the neurochemistry aspect, the brain reality of recovery, and I am Jim Kress. We're going to shift into looking at recovery versus addiction.
Yeah.
Why is this important?
Well, I think it's important to understand what recovery looks like. The addict, the definition of an addiction, is the avoidance of reality. And recovery is just the opposite, Jim. It is learning how to stay present. It's learning how to stay in the moment, and it's learning how to stay in reality, even when reality sometimes isn't much fun.
Yeah.
Most addicts have never learned how to deal with adversity. So for them, a minor adversity feels exactly like a major adversity to someone else, and because they've numbed it with things. The sex addict numbs it by the excitement of the dopamine and the escape and the fantasy, like the person with, say, cocaine or heroin or prescription pain pills. They numb it. They dampen it down. Both alter reality. They try to get away from being present, of staying in that day-to-day, moment-to-moment interaction with God and in that daily surrender. There, an addict is always either a day ahead or a day behind.
Wow. Yeah.
And a recovering person is today. Tomorrow is under the sovereignty of God. Yesterday is under the blood of the cross. And Paul says in Philippians, not that I have accomplished it yet, I press on. That is, we're in the present, leaving behind what is past. I press on. What have I done today to stay present with myself, present with my wife, present with God? And if I live in tomorrow, I'm in deficit spending.
You've talked often, I love that, about this, and once you come to it again, this conscious contact with God, the idea, some people certainly have said the serenity prayer, they do something to ground themselves, to center themselves. They will do meditation. I've talked with guys before and say, you know, meditate, don't medicate. And why, if it is hard for addicts to quiet themselves before God, maybe certainly early in recovery, or to meditate, why would an addict, we're thinking neurochemically here and otherwise, why would an addict find it so hard to have this conscious contact with God and or to meditate?
Well, if they have spent all their time avoiding reality and they're living in that response to trauma and they're living in that amygdala place, they can't be still because they don't know still. One of the things that we have truly found, and there's been research to prove this, that as people stay in conscious contact, that is, that they're just talking with God on a regular basis throughout their day, what they've found is they begin to build a new neuronal pathway from that area of trauma memory to their prefrontal lobe, which helps them to begin to process it different. So if they're triggered by something, the more they've stayed in contemplative prayer, the faster they go, wait a minute, I know what that is, and that's not where I want to be, and they can make an alternative change. If they begin to deviate from their present, wait a minute, I'm going into fantasy, I need to come back. We have to build these new neuronal pathways, and part of recovery is learning how to really stay in conscious contact with yourself. That is, what am I feeling? What's going on? Conscious contact with God. That is, staying in contemplative prayer with Him multiple times a day. And conscious contact with another, either recovery community, a married man with his spouse. But that sense of getting to know another and being known by that other.
Intimacy, right?
Intimacy. Intimacy is not sexual. Although intimacy is a part of sex, intimacy is being known. It is being able to be with a person without fear that that person will use what I share against me. It's for a man to be vulnerable. That is, I don't know what to do next. This does scare me. Men have trouble being able to share that with their wives. And true intimacy is learning how for both of them to trust that the other is not going to use what they share against them.
If that intimacy is, as has been posited by some, into me see, to like take Genesis 3, you know, and take all those fig leaves off and say, this is who I really am, that can scare a person, may I say, or an addict to death.
Absolutely. If you have been avoiding reality all of your life, and if some of the reality you've been in, you really want to avoid because it was traumatic, to be told to be present is like, you've got to be kidding me. One, I don't even know what present is.
Yeah.
And two, that means I have to feel. And if I feel, that means I'm going to have to take on something I have never taken on. And how am I going to do that? Especially without my best friend, my drug.
Yeah, I think of Scott Peck, the late Scott Peck, who said mental health is commitment to reality at all costs. If I want good mental health to face reality, and we have lived as addicts, you and I both are recovering addicts, and you live as an addict avoiding reality at all cost, and you do develop some mental health and relational and other problems, don't you?
Absolutely. You can't be real with another person if you lived in deception.
Yeah.
But what the real tragedy is, you can't be real with yourself. Most of us do not know the man or the woman we live with. We share a closet with someone that we are afraid to be with,
yeah,
or be around. Frequently, we turn on TV, the radio, as soon as we're alone because we don't like to be present with the person that we are. And recovery is learning how to enjoy this person that God made and who God likes. I don't like somebody that God likes. I got to learn to make a change.
All right, let's, as we're going to near our time to end today on our program of A Place for Healing, let's talk about this thing that I've heard rumored about that you've been known to teach. Who knows, maybe I've been known to teach, that for a recovering sex addict, someone entering recovery, we might ask them to consider a 90-day sexual abstinence period, 90 days, and no sex with their spouse for married people, and certainly no sex, masturbation, looking at porn, no sex with self. Right away, you get these bevies of guys going, you won't understand. I will explode. I will die. I cannot make it. Science says, research shows, maybe the Bible says. So guys go, I will die if I don't have sex. What are you talking about 90 days? That's crazy.
We don't die from a lack of sex. That just isn't going to happen. The average male, say a 40-year-old man, will spontaneously ejaculate about every 35 or 40 days if he doesn't have sex. God set it up to manage it. The idea that that I need sex every 2 to 3 days, or I have to have sex every 2 to 3 days, no, I want it.
Right.
It's not that a physiological need. So when we ask for an abstinence, we're really asking for an emotional, spiritual, physical type of abstinence. That is, it's not, I'm not going to talk with you. It is, we take sex off the table. And so we take sexual touch off the table. The couple makes an abstinence contract of what's the type of touch we're comfortable with. What can we handle? And what takes place usually is they begin to move closer. They start spending time with each other. They start listening to each other. They find they're talking with each other. And what is happening is that oxytocin is building. And they find that they truly want to celebrate their love sexually as a natural outgrowth of the intimacy that they've been building over these 90 days. The reason we say 90 days is it takes a period of time for some of those neuronal pathways to get started to be built. We believe and have seen clinically anyways that this amount of time is necessary for that spiritual emotional bonding and in all probability for some re-regulation of brain chemistry. If I'm not flooding the brain with my drug and I'm giving my brain a chance to detox and down-regulate to what God originally intended, it may take me 30, 60, 90 days. We're saying 90 days because what we have found is it takes 30 days for her to trust that he's going to not go north or south on her when he touches her, and then another 30 days for them to find that this is kind of fun, and another 30 days to find that, wait a minute, something special is happening.
And you have actually brought in some major empirical, wink, wink, research about a female ferret, and you teach these guys this. Do you taught this? And I remember going, I'm going to go out one day. I'd been around you for a number of years at that time, and I went out to Google, and I searched it, and it came up, and I thought, that rascal Ted, he is right about this. I thought, you know, what is the female ferret? What's that have to do with this?
I tell guys that you will not die from a lack of sex.
Right.
But there is one animal in the animal kingdom that does, and that is the female ferret. And the female ferret, if her estrogen level gets so high, if she's not bred, literally it can take her, you know, literally dissolve her bones. And I have never seen a sex addict that even resembles a female ferret. So I'm pretty certain that these guys will not die from a lack of sex.
That is encouraging news, and yet we see guys panic when we teach this at a workshop and go, what? 90 days? And, well, Ted, it's been a pleasure being with you today here. If there's one thought, whether that is, quote, spiritual, psychological, relational, all about the neurochemistry or about anything, what do you want to leave with our listeners today, just a way to encourage them as we wrap up our program?
One, that recovery is possible. Mm-hmm. It's just not easy. And most things that are really worth something take effort.
Yeah. It's not easy. Carnes has found maybe even a 3 to 5 year program. And is it easy? No. Is it worth it? Yes. Often, and I'm paraphrasing an old quote, recovery has not been tried and found difficult. Recovery has been found difficult and then left untried. Ted?
What I would say is that I hope for sexual addicts that they would have no regret. They would have no retreat in their recovery.
Dr. Ted Baldick with us today on A Place for Healing, and we thank you, Ted, for being with us.
Thanks, Jim, for having me.
Yeah, and again, there are a lot of these other programs on the website. If you point your web browser to www.BethesdaWorkshops.org, that's BethesdaWorkshops.org, to find out about our workshops for men, for partners or spouses, for even female sex addicts, and for couples. There's a lot to see there. And pass the word. Maybe even get your church to put a link to BethesdaWorkshops.org on their church website. And of course, if you'd like to use the old telephone to call, it's a toll-free call, 866-464-HEAL, H-E-A-L. That's the way to remember it. That's 866-464-HEAL. Now, for everyone who's been a part of our program today, we thank you for listening. And certainly for my good friend and colleague, Dr. Ted Baldick. I'm Jim Kress. We'll see you next time right here on A Place for Healing from Bethesda Workshops.